The second matter on our calendar today.
Our second case is 819-0243, Pauline Christine Jensen, petitioner appellant versus commissioner of public safety respondent.
And council, please take your time to get settled into council table. I'll just make a few quick remarks, but you can ignore me or at least listen at one side, and then we'll just gradually get to the point where we're ready to begin the argument. So I'll just remind you of a couple of quick things that you're probably well aware of, but I'll just make sure that you remember them today, which is please take your time to get whatever materials that you would like to have at council table available for you, and then make whatever adjustments you'd like so that microphone is adjustable as well as the height of the podium. So take a few moments. And then before you start your argument, actually every time you're at the podium, if you would identify yourself for the record and the party that you represent, that will greatly facilitate our oral record of today. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jeffrey Sheridan, and I am the attorney for the appellant in this case. Her name is Pauline Jensen. This matter is before the court this morning following a district court order sustaining the revocation of the appellant's driving privileges under Minnesota statute. This is the new sort of fluid implied consent law, Minnesota statute 171.177. Facts for your consideration are that the officer obtained a warrant to obtain a blood sample from Ms. Jensen, but did not provide her with the statutorily mandated advisory before he executed that warrant in telling Ms. Jensen that the refusal to submit to the test was a criminal offense.
What is the warning designed to do?
Well, I try not to read the legislature's mind whenever possible, but
this one seems to be pretty easy. Usually it's hard, but
sure.
Advising the individual that refusal to take a test is a crime.
Okay.
What's the purpose of that?
I would imagine to put the person on notice that if they refuse to submit after being told that there is a warrant to search them, that they could be prosecuted for an additional offense of refusal to submit to the alcohol concentration test.
So what are the consequences, if any, to not giving the warning in this case?
Well, had she refused to submit to the test...
Well, she didn't refuse.
She did not.
So what are the consequences of the... Now, if she had refused and not been given the warning,
sure,
we might infer that, well, She refused because she wasn't aware it was a crime, and she was supposed to be aware of that, and the officer was supposed to make her aware of that. But what are the consequences? What, if any, relevant consequences to the failure of this advisory?
The most relevant of the consequences is that the police officer failed to follow the requirements necessary to do what this case is about, and that is to revoke a person's driver's license.
Well, that's a legal
without issue. A prior hearing.
I'm talking about a practical effect. What practical effect on your client's behavior or the testing resulted from the failure to give the warning?
I don't know, Your Honor, because the warning was never given. So what effect that may have had on her decision-making process is unknowable.
But what relevant effect might it have had?
That she was not told that? I'm assuming you're getting at the fact that the officer could have, even if she had refused to submit to the warrant, could have forced a blood draw, and that is somehow relevant to the conversation here today. I just disagree with that. I know counsel has invited you to go down this rabbit hole.
I understand your answer. You're saying you can't think of a practical consequence, but that doesn't matter in the legal analysis.
Well, I think this case can be decided within the four corners of this statute.
Right, but I just want to understand your
sure.
argument. Do you agree that is really what we're talking about here, that there is no practical effect on the refusal to give the warning as to your client's conduct? The effect is only a legal one.
There is no knowable effect.
Or even hypothetical effect.
Well,
you can't think of one as you're sitting here. I can't either.
Okay. Fair enough. We could go around about that for a while. But yes, I mean, Here, again, I mean, counsel in their response to this is inviting you to kind of go down the rabbit hole and start viewing this as an evidence-gathering statute. This is not an evidence-gathering statute. The search
warrants. How was your client prejudiced by the failure to give the warrant? What harm did she suffer?
She suffered a pre-hearing revocation of her driving privileges.
As a result of the failure to give the warning, or as a result of her testing over the limit?
As a result of the testing over the limit, but not within the statutory confines.
Okay, but just so, how was she prejudiced by the failure to give the warning? I'm asking this because I think it's Johnson from the Supreme Court analyzing McDonald says, you know what, enough. You don't get relief here unless you can show the misinformation or the lack of information somehow prejudiced you and impacted your actions. If we apply that concept here, we would say, how was your client prejudiced by the failure to give this warning?
This is, again, a trip down the rabbit hole for no good reason. Johnson and Morehouse, those decisions had to do with a challenge to a due process challenge to the way in which the person was advised. And in the context of a due process challenge, indeed, the
you need prejudice.
Right.
So what you would say is, okay, but due process challenge, you need to show prejudice, according to the Supreme Court. This isn't a due process challenge.
This is
language of the statute. It wasn't complied with. Therefore, no revocation. What law says failure to comply with the plain language of the revocation statute means no revocation?
171.177.
Where does it say that?
This is entirely because it starts with the beginning of the number one.
It says person must be informed. Absolutely.
Correct.
And
all right.
This court has said in an opinion I wrote that's unambiguous. There are no exceptions.
Correct.
Where in 171.177 does it say, and if you don't do that, you may not have a license revocation?
In the subdivision 11, which talks about the petition for judicial review and the issues I'm sorry, I was looking at subdivision 11.
Sure.
States that that's where you need to state with specificity the grounds, and then subdivision 12 sets forth the 13 items that you're permitted to litigate in a 171.177 case.
The problem I had with your argument.
Okay.
You point to those in your brief, and there's a couple of places I'll just ask you to.
Sure.
And maybe it just is a parallel to Judge Larkin's question. On the top of page 11 in your brief, you say that subdivision 12D provides that for the court to sustain a license revocation, the commissioner must prove each of the 13 listed conditions precedent to a lawful revocation. And you cite to 12B, subdivision 12B, and you make a similar argument elsewhere, where on page 13, which is almost identical, that the remedy for the commissioner's failure to prove any of the listed conditions is that the court shall order revocation, that the revocation be rescinded. So what is the language, quote for us the language, that supports that bright line requirement?
Well, the first place I would refer you is to the rules of statutory construction. Okay, the rules of statutory construction tell us that when words of the law and their application to an existing, let me get this, gonna need the cheaters here for this. When the words of a law and in their application to an existing situation is clear and free from all ambiguity, the letter of the law shall not be disregarded under the pretext of pursuing the spirit.
Right, so I'm trying to get a sense of what is the language in the statute that you're saying is unambiguous.
Sure.
And we shouldn't look beyond it.
Well, the language of the statute that's unambiguous is, number one, the officer must read the advisory. That is mandatory language.
That's given.
Okay.
We understand that.
Number two, the driver has the right under the same statute to challenge the revocation and provides the 13 grounds upon which the driver may bring a challenge, one of which, of course, is that at the time of directing the person to take the test, did the peace officer inform the person that refusing a test was a crime as required by subdivision 1? That is one of the things that a driver gets to say is, I wasn't given the advisory.
So if I understand your argument, you're saying there is no express language in this statute requiring what you're saying, but we should infer it from the bases that can be considered in the revocation hearing.
Well, these are all grounds upon which the revocation can be rescinded. That's the 13 items.
But there's no express language saying what you say in your brief, which is that the commissioner must prove each of the 13 listed conditions that are precedent to a lawful revocation. Otherwise, there's in the hearing, there's a rescission of the revocation. You're saying we should infer that these 13 things must be proved by the commissioner.
And again, I'd go back to the rules of statutory construction specifically.
Yes or no? You're saying yes, that is required by inference.
By inference, yes.
So let me ask it this way. Do you have the statute handy, the 0.177?
I do.
Okay. So let's assume this was a case of refusal as opposed to a test. And I wanted to look at factor number 11.
Sure. Obviously not applicable to a refusal case.
Well, right. The factor is, was the testing method used valid and reliable? So what if the commissioner didn't prove that element in a refusal case? Would that be a ground for rescission?
No. Because there was no test.
Because there's no test. Because there's no consequence.
Correct.
No.
Because it's inapplicable to the case. Not because there's no consequence.
Okay. Well, let me ask it that way. Why is it applicable to this case that an individual have the right to refuse? Or that that refusing
was an option.
Would subject the individual to a criminal penalty?
Which
when there was no refusal. So why is it applicable to this hearing?
Because everybody is entitled to, some of these are applicable to every single situation. Whether or not the person was lawfully placed under arrest for a violation, whether the person was involved in a motor vehicle accident.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was getting to, basically,
right.
That some of these elements seem to apply to refusals, some apply only to test results, and some apply to both.
Correct.
But I think, I gather what you're saying is, if it doesn't apply to your circumstance, it's not a mandatory element to be proved by the commissioner before for revocation, pre-hearing revocation.
Okay. I mean, I would accept that.
So
but
why isn't the notification that refusal is a crime one of those circumstances when the individual didn't refuse?
Because the statute doesn't limit that the use of that. The statute says that when an officer obtains a search warrant for a fluid test, the officer must provide this advisory at the time of searching that warrant. That is applicable to all cases in which an officer has obtained a warrant for a fluid test. So there's no dispute that in this case the officer obtained a warrant for a fluid test and that the statute mandates that he must provide a warning at the time that he's executing that warrant, and there's no dispute that that did not occur in this case. There is also no dispute that that is among the grounds upon which a person may challenge the revocation of their driving privilege. And again, we're not talking about whether they can use the evidence in a criminal case. We're not talking about anything other than this.
And from that, you infer that because there's this mandatory requirement, and because failure to comply with that mandatory requirement is an issue that can be raised at a license revocation hearing, we should infer that failure to comply with that requirement is grounds to reverse the revocation.
Right.
So it's not stated expressly, but it's implied.
Right.
Can I ask you this? Are you familiar with the case of Tyler versus Commissioner of Public Safety, 1985 case?
I am probably familiar with it, but not by name. So it's not ringing a bell for me. Let me just finish up on that thought, okay? And again, my position is that you can decide this. This would be the simplest case you decide this year by keeping yourselves within the four corners of this statute, because the rules of statutory construction tell us that the legislature does not intend a result that is absurd, impossible of execution, or unreasonable, and that the legislature intends the entire statute to be effective and certain. So the idea that's being advocated by the state here is that you should agree that this is an issue that can be raised in a 171-177 hearing, but it's just an issue for interesting conversation, that it has no actual legal effect.
Well, no, it would have actual legal effect in a refusal case. One of the things that the Supreme Court said in Tyler, which was a case in which a license revocation was challenged on the ground that the advisory was not given, was that it would be improper and unfair to revoke a driver's license for refusing to take a test if an advisory were not given. One could argue, on the other hand, that failure to give an advisory should not make any difference in a case where the revocation is based on test results showing that the driver had a blood alcohol concentration greater than 0.10 or more, because, you know, whether you take or refuse, you're still getting revoked, and if you had refused, you'd be revoked for a longer period of time. So again, going back to the prejudice. Now, in all honesty, since you're not familiar with the case or you don't recognize it by name, the Supreme Court also said compliance with the procedures of the implied consent law is a prerequisite to revocation pursuant to the implied consent law. So the question I have when I read that in Tyler is, you know, you refer to 171.177 as the fluid implied consent law, which seems odd to me because I understand the implied consent law to be a law that applies when we don't have a warrant. The implied consent process is the substitute for a warrant. Right. And when we get to 171.177, we have a warrant. We're not talking about an implied consent process, which causes me to ask whether the Supreme Court's statement in Tyler, which is consistent with your argument that, you know, there's an inference that failure to comply obtains relief, I question whether that applies when we're outside of the implied consent context.
And all I would do is ask you to take a look at what the implied consent law of 1985, pre-1985, looked like, which was 169.123, and it was basically four or five paragraphs of law. We're now dealing with an implied consent or a license revocation law that is considerably longer and far more specific as to what is required.
Right, but would you at least agree we're not dealing with an implied consent law?
I would.
In this case.
I'm so used to dealing in the implied consent setting that I refer to the license revocation law in that fashion. And you're correct. That was an imprecise use of language.
Right. So,
great. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Melchione from the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I am representing Respondent Commissioner of Public Safety in this appeal. I think there are two factors that distinguish this case from most of the cases that appellant relies on in seeking you to reverse the decision of the district court. That this is a CVO case, a criminal vehicular operation case, and that a warrant was obtained prior to any testing being taken. As to the first issue, this 171.177 issue, I think Judge Ross, I think your questions were apposite in that there was no consequence for the failure of the officer to read subdivision one.
And I think that's clear. I think that's pretty clear, and it's almost conceded. But here's my problem: you didn't cite Tyler, or your opponent didn't cite Tyler. Are you familiar with that case?
I am familiar with Tyler.
Okay, yes. So you explain around this if you can. So the Tyler court says, well, maybe we could use this. You could use this evidence in a criminal prosecution, but you can't use the test results in a revocation because the implied consent advisory wasn't given. And the court actually recognized that, well, in this case, arguably, there's really no consequence to it because you have a consent. And if the driver consented, you know, no harm, no foul in not giving the warning, which was designed to encourage consent. In that case, the court held that a violation of the implied consent requirement to give the advisory was enough to require that the revocation be rescinded. In other words, even when there's no consequence, So how do you, I'm glad you're familiar with Tyler, explain how it is that we can affirm with that reasoning in mind.
And I'm probably not as intimately as familiar as the court is, but Judge Larkin's explanation did jog my memory of the case. I think the really apposite distinction from Tyler here is that Tyler was dealing with the implied consent statute, which is purely administrative in nature. It is just the officer and the driver going through this process, and this process is what results in the revocation. In this case, and in under all 171-177 cases, because a warrant has been obtained, the process itself is substantially different. And now that a warrant has been obtained, it almost obfuscates the need in cases where someone goes along to give them that advisory.
The same argument I think is true in Tyler. If a person consents, it obfuscates the need for there to have been an advisory that was designed to encourage consent. The statute doesn't offer the express exception. The statute doesn't say that the officer must warn the driver that refusal is a crime unless there was a warrant issued for the
right. I think the exception, the analogy would be in Hunn. The Supreme Court said that an officer can simply decide to skip the implied consent process entirely and ask for consent, and that's fine, right? What Tyler is saying is where an officer chooses to invoke the implied consent process, again, which is not what we're talking about here, but where an officer chooses to invoke this administrative process, you have to read the advisory because it is part of that administrative process.
Can't you say the same thing for 171, 177? It's not the implied consent process, but it's an administrative process by which you can have a pre-hearing license revocation.
But I think the distinction is how it's invoked. 161, so 169.123 or 169A.51 to 54 is invoked by the officer reading this advisory, saying, I am invoking this process. That's how it starts. Under 171.177, the process is invoked when the officer obtains the warrant. That is the precondition for the application of 171.177, when the officer obtains the warrant. That's what triggers the remainder of this process. It is not the reading of the instruction or the language of 171.177 subdivision 1.
Well, I think the problem with that argument is that also part of 171.177 is subdivision 12, paragraph 7, which includes, as in the implied consent setting, at the time, the issue being at the time of directing the person to take the test, did the peace officer inform the person that refusing the test was a crime as required by subdivision 1? So I appreciate your distinction, but it seems as if the legislature didn't make that same distinction. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think the best way to view the issues is they are issues that may be raised when they are applicable. For example, there are numerous issues in subdivision 12 that don't apply in refusal cases or in test cases. And this is raised in page 10 of our brief. One of the examples is, one of the issues to be raised is, was there a motor vehicle accident? And that obviously doesn't apply in non-motor vehicle cases. Was the testing method valid and reliable? That doesn't apply in refusal cases. Similarly, the issue of whether or not subdivision 1 was read only applies in cases where it matters, where it has some type of impact. And that would be, I think, in just the refusal cases, where someone says, I'm not going to comply with this warrant. Then I think in order to revoke someone for refusal, you would have to tell them that refusal to take the test is a crime.
And again, I think your impact argument is a valid logical argument, but I don't know that you've sufficiently distinguished Tyler, where the impact issue was considered but rejected as a basis for sustaining the revocation.
Well, and I think the important thing is that in Tyler, we were outside of a warrant kind of scheme. I think this warrant umbrella colors the entirety of the remainder of the process.
That could be, but I'm just referring to the logic that was used by the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court essentially said, we could consider the fact that this failure by the officer is inconsequential. And in fact, if this were, we're talking about suppression of evidence, we would say that matters. But in this case, we'll say simply administrative process wasn't satisfied, and therefore the administrative revocation can't be sustained. It seems that was the reasoning.
That was the reasoning in Tyler, but I think that the reasoning in Tyler is apposite in that case because it is a purely administrative process. I think we have to keep coming back, and I think this court did so a few weeks ago in Platt v. Commissioner of Public Safety, which is an unpublished opinion on the same issue, and said, look, where there is no import to that statement, where it is rendered superfluous,
not quite the same case. I mean, in that case, it was unpublished first, but the other, if I recall the facts of that case accurately, that was a circumstance where the advisory wasn't given because the driver was interfering with the officer's opportunity to give the advisory, and so our court said, you know what, we're not going to reach the question of whether it's consequential, because in this case, the officer is excused from giving the advisory because of the defendant's conduct. Do I misrecall?
I think that was the ultimate import because it was a refusal case. But importantly, in the facts in Platt, the driver had agreed to take a urine test before ever having read any of Subdivision 1. And that process was proceeding. And then when it became evident that the driver was refusing by not giving the urine sample, that is when the officer had to advise him of the Subdivision 1 refusal as a crime, and that's where his conduct interfered. When the officer tried to come into the room and say...
Right, but isn't that the issue that you're talking about? The officer's failure to give the instruction, it was excused in that case by this court expressly, not because it was inconsequential, but because the driver prohibited the officer from giving the advisory. Do you recall those facts the same way I do in that case?
I do recall the facts the same way you do, but I think one of the important factors to take away from that case is the officer did not read the Subdivision 1 language before the driver went into the room to give that urine sample. If we adopt appellant's argument that any time that Subdivision 1 is not read, even when someone agrees to go along with the warrant and take the test, that whole process would have been invalidated in Platt because the officer did not read the Subdivision 1 language before Platt.
That issue raised in Platt?
I believe it was. I argued it, so I believe it was. I know I at least in my oral argument we discussed it, that the import of that subdivision did not come into effect until the refusal was apparent. And that I know we discussed that with the panel.
When I say was it... Part yes, of Platt, was it in the analysis of our court?
It was not explicitly in the analysis of the court, but when you compare the facts with the analysis, I don't see how you can escape that implicit conclusion.
Well, if the analysis doesn't include it as an issue, then the court didn't. We can't assume that the court considered it as an issue.
But if the entirety of the process is invalidated according to appellant's logic, this court never should have reached my argument, which is that there was no import until the refusal became apparent.
But if that issue wasn't presented to the court, we're not going to create it and decide it.
It wasn't explicit in the court's opinion.
In any case, Platt's not published, so
right.
You'd be asking us to draw an inference
correct.
On an analysis that didn't occur in a case that's not published and binding. So you might have stronger arguments than Platt.
Correct. But
counsel,
I think it's... Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, finish.
I think it's important to distinguish Tyler from all of the subsequent cases, such as Halleck, where we're talking about an entire failure to read the advisory, which is Tyler, versus a simple deficiency. In this case, the driver was served with the warrant and told that a warrant existed for their blood. So they were told what the process was and how it was occurring. If we want to draw an analogy from this case to the prior case law, it's more opposite to Halleck of an incomplete advisory than Tyler, no advisory. Because the driver was aware that there was a warrant, it was signed by a judge, it was for her blood, and she was being taken to do the blood draw.
The incomplete advisory, that's not part of the advisory, is it? The existence of a warrant? My understanding of the record was that we don't know what the officer told the driver, right?
I don't like necessarily calling it an advisory because I think there's just some information that needs to be conveyed. And part of the information that is conveyed here is that the existence of a warrant, and on page 15 of the transcript, the officer did serve appellant with a copy of the warrant and inform her that a warrant existed for her blood.
But Section 177.177 has one subdivision entitled testing advisory, and the only information it requires be given is that the person must be informed that refusal to submit to a blood or urine test is a crime. It doesn't say anything about they must be told there's a warrant, the warrant's been authorized by a judge, et cetera. And you seem to be saying, well, because she was told those things, we don't have a problem. Well, those things aren't required in the first place under the statute.
Well, I think they are, because when someone...
But the focus of this case is, what is clearly required is that the person must be informed that refusal to submit to a blood or urine test is a crime. And that didn't happen.
Right.
And it seems to me that what you're essentially saying is that we should read subdivision 12B7, the list of issues that may be raised, in this matter. In the case of a test refusal, at the time of directing the person to take the test, did the peace officer inform the person that refusing the test was a crime as required by subdivision 1? In other words, you would have us read this statute, specifically paragraph 7, to apply only in refusal cases.
Broad umbrella, yes, but even more specific to this case, which is a CVO, we're dealing with an even smaller subset of test cases because this is a criminal vehicular operation case.
Okay, so you're asking us to read two things in the statute. One, you're asking us to read language into paragraph 7, saying that paragraph 7 is only a legitimate issue in the case of a refusal, and then also, I guess, a whole new paragraph saying, well, you don't need any advisory if it's a CVO case.
No, we're asking this court to leave these issues to the district court, which is what we do in all of the other cases.
Leave what issues to the district court? Whenever what the remedy is?
Well, whenever any of these issues are raised, the district court must determine if it's applicable to the instant case. For example, you know, whether the testing method is valid and reliable, whether the person refused testing, whether the person refused the PBT. All of these issues that can be raised are only appropriate where they're applicable on the merits. They're not, none of them are automatic triggers for rescission unless they apply to the case. So they have to apply on the facts of the case.
But here's the problem. At the time the advisory is given, there hasn't been a refusal. I mean, you seem to be saying, well, we don't need this advisory because there wasn't a refusal. But at the time the police officer is required to say something to the driver, we don't know if there's been a refusal. So the only thing he can do is provide this advisory. So it seems to be always applicable.
The statute also doesn't say when the advisory must be given. It also could be the context of...
Well, yes, it does. It says at the time a blood or urine test is directed pursuant to a search warrant.
But the time of directing, it's the entirety of the direction of that blood draw. It is not simply...
Well, it's before the blood draw. Can we agree with that?
Right. It would have to be before the blood draw. But if someone refuses... then you could give them that advisory. From a practical standpoint, if you say, and I see my time has expired, I'd just like to finish this answer. The practical import of this, the way it would actually work in real life, is in a non-CVO case where someone says, I have a warrant for your blood, and the person says, okay, let's go, the officer has no need to read subdivision 1 because it's not applicable. But whereas someone says, I'm not going to do that, you know, go pound sand, officer, that's where the officer would then come in and say, refusal to comply with this warrant is a crime, and if that changes the person's opinion, great, and if not, then it's a refusal. But it's not a refusal until that is read.
May I ask one quick follow-up?
Go ahead.
I hope it's quick. Maybe make your answer brief.
I'll try.
But can you address the fact that what we're talking about here is just a pre-hearing revocation, and that in the case of a criminal vehicular operation, the state can still... even without the pre-hearing revocation, still obtain a revocation of the same length simply by a conviction. Is that accurate or not accurate?
There are a lot of problems that come along with that. We're assuming a conviction is obtained.
Yes.
But that's we dual track this to keep those two processes separate. What you're talking about is the suspension for CVO, and what we're talking about here is a revocation that would be entirely independent of the criminal process. So I think there's value in keeping those.
But in the criminal process, assuming charges are filed, I guess unless it's cash-only bail, there's a reasonable likelihood that the district court would impose conditions of release, including no driving.
It's entirely possible. But I think there's also the implication of, you know, the pre-hearing suspension only exists for 90 days if charges aren't filed. So if charges take too long to be filed, the driving privileges would then become valid again without without the civil administrative side.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll add some time just to equal things out if you need it. You don't have to take it if you don't want
it. Or if you want it, you might want to run for it. You might want to get out
right,
of it.
Right, any of
yes,
it.
That's probably a better way to say it if you
want. No. I'm going to start at where you all ended because it was another trip down a rabbit hole. What counsel was referring to is the fact that once a CVO charge is filed, the commissioner, in addition to this revocation, also suspends the driver's license indefinitely until the matter is resolved. So actually, by doing this particular process, it actually has the effect of lengthening the license revocation if they wait for the conviction, because the revocation would be served after a conviction, but during the pendency of the case, they would actually have been under suspension with no hardship relief at all, so they wouldn't even been able to be on ignition interlock. So in answer to your question, it actually is worse if you wait to convict someone, because they're going to serve out both a suspension and then a revocation after the conviction comes down. So it's a whole different rabbit hole, one that's not in front of you today. I've now had the opportunity during counsel's argument to read through Tyler, and I agree with Tyler. Yes, this is a license revocation proceeding. It's a specific administrative process that has specific administrative rules associated with it, and the legislature has defined there is no such thing as common law license revocation. It is a statutory animal. It comes with a statutory set of rules to grant to the commissioner this extraordinary power of taking property without a prior hearing, and they have to jump through those hoops. And it might not seem like it's all that important to them or that it makes a lot of sense to them that you would hold their feet to the fire, but we're talking about an extraordinary process in American jurisprudence, and that is the right to take property without a prior hearing.
What about the why doesn't subdivision 13B of 171-177 allow us to distinguish Tyler's reasoning from this case?
The same thing was true at the time of Tyler. In fact, the officer sidestepped the whole process just to do what he wanted to do, which was take the blood regardless of whether the person would consented to it. And remember, at the time, we were living in the post-Schmerber world where the perception is that any kind of blood draw was perfectly legal against the person's
will. But in
Tyler,
there was consent.
And I agree, but I'm saying that the fact that, and what I talk about in the second argument there, is that at the time of Tyler, there was certainly no perception that you needed either consent or the implied consent process. The interpretation of Schmerber at the time in the pre-Birchfield world was, or the pre-McNeely world is that you can just take this blood one way or the other. So the officer at the time, and the officer in Hunn, by the way, because Hunn was a gap case between the decision in Birchfield and when this new law took effect, is that the officer had the ability to just forego the license revocation process entirely and say, I don't care about that, I just want that blood, and go get it. And and he could do that because he believed his evidence gathering was more important than the ability to obtain a license revocation. And when the commissioner comes in on the backside of that and says, well, now that you have that evidence, we're gonna go ahead and revoke anyway, even though the officer did not invoke our process, we're going to revoke the driver's license anyway. So it's exactly the same as it was as in Tyler, because in this case, the officer, for whatever reason, chose not to invoke the administrative procedure, but once the result came out, the commissioner decided to go ahead and revoke anyway, even though the officer had not followed the procedure. That's the problem here. Within the four corners of this law, they get to do this extraordinary thing, but only if they follow these minimal rules that are in place, starting with subdivision one. When you get a warrant, you have to tell the person this thing. And we all agree that that didn't happen, or at least that the commissioner didn't prove that it did happen. And therefore, just like in Tyler, Your decision here isn't going to have any impact on whether this can be used against her in her criminal prosecution. But it's clear that the procedure needed to take the license without a prior hearing was not followed, and the remedy for that is defined in the statute itself. It's an issue you get to challenge, and the district court gets two choices. I'm either going to rescind or sustain, and when the procedure isn't followed, the only way this section makes any sense at all is that the remedy is that the revocation should have been rescinded.
What about this concern that I have? At the time of Tyler and all the way, I suppose, up through the addition to the, this warrant addition to the statute, it was clear that the legislature had this public policy objective to get a consensual, to get the individual's consent. Given the backdrop that you've explained, the idea was officers could go take blood anytime. We just are giving the benefit. The legislature is saying, with the implied consent,
we prefer you don't. That
we prefer for you to consent, and if you choose not to consent, we're not going to allow the officer, no test shall be given. We're not going to allow the officer to McNeely you. You can't be strapped down and blood drawn. So that was the clear policy objective of the legislature, to afford Minnesota drivers that benefit, that we're going to use the test against you, or we're going to use your refusal against you, but we're not going to force you to take a test. But here, it seems to me under 13B, there's a deviation from that, where the legislature says, on this point, when there's a warrant, we are no longer concerned about consent. We don't care anymore about whether you consent. We're going to get the blood, and the evidence gathering is more important to us than the individual's right to say no.
Okay.
And you can be McNeely'd, if you will, after there's a warrant. So why isn't that a distinction between this case and Tyler?
Because you've made the decision that you're going to get the blood, okay, evidence to be used against a person in a criminal case, okay? And at that time, the officer elected that in exchange for that, I know that I'm not going to get the license, but the commissioner revoked anyway. Again, this is not an evidence-gathering statute. This is a license revocation statute, pre-hearing license revocation
statute. Right, but within that statute is this exception. It's not, that's my point. It's
right.
The exception is within this statute, and it's not just referring to the criminal proceedings.
And it existed in the implied consent law and for time immemorial. That has always been the case, that if the person refused testing, the test shall not be given, except in the case of criminal vehicular operation or criminal vehicular homicide. That has always been in place. So that was in place at the time of Tyler, just as it is today. So I don't think there's any, that isn't a distinction today. So the officer in Tyler chose not to read the advisory. The officer here chose not to read the advisory.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Our thanks to counsel.